since Eric has transformed himself into a participant, I've been dragooned into chairing this session. And so the first person who wants to say something is Eric, who I guess is going to give a summary of yesterday, I was told, or something like that.
Can we turn off the blue thing? Does anyone know how to do that? So as Sandy points out, I decided that the passivity of just being the guy who passes around the microphone was driving me crazy. And so I've given the microphone off to Sandy. This is really, I think, something of a summary of what we heard yesterday about fermionic superfluidity or fermionic condensation. Question, why can't we all just get along? And my answer is that we can, and to a certain extent we do. And towards this end, I want to suggest that there exists, even if we don't appreciate it, a Santa Barbara consensus. In that most of us all agree, the people who have been especially, if you listen carefully to what the theorists are saying, most of them are saying the same thing, or something close enough to the same thing. And I want to emphasize now the things that they're saying, that everybody is saying, that is the same. And then I say, when I say thanks everyone, what I really mean to say is that very few of any of these ideas are mine. They're really supposed to be a summary of what we've heard from the theorists. And I must admit also from reading some of the theorist papers. And in a moment of weakness, I actually did some of that. So what I'm going to talk about just in these few minutes is, first of all, what it is I think, what I mean by the consensus, what it is we all know about microscopic atomic physics, this very broad Feshbach resonance, the narrow limit, some nomenclature suggestions, if I ruled the world, how I would call things instead of what other people call things. And then finally, a suggestion of what we don't know, or at least not all of us certainly know, and what I at least would really wish we did know. And this is a list of some questions. Some of these questions are from Jason Ho's famous original list, and some of them are additional questions. Basically, we understand the microscopic physics, and I have to, a lot of people don't care about this at all, but as an atomic physicist, I have to insist that, yeah, at some very short range, there really do exist two channels. And or call them two spins. They're roughly speaking singlet and triplet spin channels, although it's not exactly like that. They're coupled at short distances. But for some distance between the atom, between two atoms, which is large compared to RC, the singlet triplet coupling, and indeed the physical interaction between the two particles vanish. The one channel is sometimes referred to as the singlet channel or the closed channel, or unfortunately sometimes the molecule channel. It's better to call it a bare or a fictitious molecule or the Bose field. The open channel is sometimes called a triplet channel or an open channel or an atom field or sometimes the fermion field, depending on how people are describing it. You'll hear different vocabulary. Sorry? Because it doesn't have too much to do with the actual physical molecule that we actually end up observing in most of the experiments. That's all. I mean, it certainly is a molecule. Nothing wrong with that. It's just not the molecule we care about. Sure, in many cases it's a virtual state. Okay, so then number two, there exists a broad Feshbach resonance where the breadth of the width of the resonance in some unit square becomes much larger than the Fermi energy. And I think the Santa Barbara consensus is that this is the relevant limit for current potassium and lithium experiments. Randy's? Yes.
Definitely narrow.
Narrow? Oh, you're doing the narrow one. Excuse me. I'm sorry. Good. Good. So that we'll get to that in a second. So for the broad lithium experiments, and there exist various different Hamiltonian models, including something that looks like a point contact between fermions, something that looks like a realistic interatomic but single channel interatomic potential, something that looks like a Bose field coupled to a fermion field. There's various different models. These different coefficients, these bare coefficients, in many cases have some B field dependence. But because of the magic of field theorists, which I don't understand, they take these different Hamiltonians, which seem very different, churn them together, and they all find that as long as they're in the so-called broad Feshbach resonance, that they get the results of the broad Feshbach resonance Santa Barbara consensus, which is that in the experimentally relevant region, the molecules, the Cooper pairs, the whatever sort of pairing you want to call in the crossover region, all of them have a characteristic size which is much, much larger than RC, which is this physical limit within which the different channels talk to each other microscopically, the physical limit of the interaction potential.
What is this RC in potassium?
Call it something less than 50 angstroms, 100 angstroms. And moreover, the molecules, the Cooper pairs, the crossover pairs, and also the atoms are pretty much all in the pure, or pure in the sense that we're truly in the broad Feshbach resonance. They are purely in the open channel, the triplet channel, the atom channel, the fermionic channel, or whatever we want to call it. And this has experimental consequences. This isn't just a matter of vocabulary. If you measure the magnetic moment of any of these things, or the atoms, the molecules, the Cooper pairs, they all have the magnetic moment associated with the open channel. So this is physically the case. They have, and there's in this broad Feshbach limit, the two-body physics has a bound state on one side of the resonance, which where the binding energy is proportional to 1 over a squared, is proportional to the magnetic field squared, the detuning of the magnetic field squared. And in particular, this binding energy is not linear in delta B, it's quadratic in delta B, at least until the binding energy becomes much larger than the Fermi energy. And this is basically the way I see the meaning of this broad Fermi Feshbach resonance limit, as long as you have this case. On the other side of the resonance, you don't have a bound state at all. You have a very broad two-body above threshold scattering resonance, but it's not particularly well-defined beast. If you go very, very far down here, eventually you will get to a place where this molecule state here now again looks like a closed channel, but it can be in this broad Feshbach resonance far away from where all the exciting physics is happening. And then, so that's the two-body physics. There also exists, I think, at least no one seems to have any problem with this, in the broad Feshbach resonance, a four-body physics idea, which is this really clever result that the molecular scattering length and low density is proportional to 0.6 times the atom-atom scattering length on the VEC side. All right, and then finally, in terms of this broad Feshbach resonance consensus, there's an idea that if we look at the critical temperature over the Fermi temperature, plotted versus 1 over KFA, we've got a BEC limit, we've got the BCS limit. If we're somewhere out here near the BEC limit, in the sense that the critical temperature is kind of getting up here, the size of this molecular pair is less than the interatomic spacing. Over near this limit, the size of the Cooper pair is large compared to the interatomic spacing. In between, there's some sort of crossover behavior. But I would say, and Wolfgang has emphasized this, Wolfgang Ketterle, that there's sort of factors of pi in here, which can actually be kind of important. So it's not clear that the exact, you know, it might be a factor of pi smaller or larger than this, where you really want to sort of associate with this asymptotic behavior. And then finally, I'd like to say that in this sort of consensus picture, there really isn't in this broad resonance consensus picture, it doesn't make so much sense to talk about these things in here as being a superposition of molecules and Cooper pairs. They're basically there's just a pair wave function between them that gets pretty small in this limit, kind of big in this limit. If you look in this crossover limit, this pair wave function has some finite overlap with atoms that with pairs you might find over here, and some finite overlap with pairs you might find over here. There's nothing really discontinuous or qualitatively different about these things. They just get smaller. All right, so that I think is the consensus of the broad Feshbach resonance, and there exists another resonance, the narrower Feshbach resonance. I say not yet experimentally relevant, but we haven't heard from Randy. I'm sorry about that, Randy. But absolutely experimentally accessible, as Randy will be showing us. And in this case, the two-body physics looks very different. In the sort of extreme case, this bound state now is roughly speaking linear in the tuning of the magnetic field, up to a distance to within the Fermi energy of the system. On the other side, you have a relatively robust above-threshold two-body state whose lifetime is long enough that it actually seems to have some sort of physical existence out here. This sort of regime now can be mocked up either using sort of boson-fermion model, having some sort of a two-channel physics, or you can, as other theorists have shown, you can mock this up in a single channel interatomic potential that now is more complicated than just a little box here. It can have some sort of little barrier here. You can mock up all of this two-body behavior and then use this if you want to do, you know, Monte Carlo kind of stuff. All right. A nomenclature plea. This is just Eric's personal preference. Oftentimes, we like to write the scattering length as background length times 1 plus this detuning thing. I don't like that, because then when you're near the resonance, the scattering length looks like A background delta over delta B. What's this A background showing up here? It sort of suggests that the background scattering length is somehow important. And we all know it's not the case, but babies are being born every day, and one of these days they're going to first encounter this, and they, you know, they're going to be, what, 5 or 6 years old? They're going to be confused. I really prefer, if we can possibly do it, to write the scattering length as A background plus now sort of redefining this width, so now that near resonance, the scattering length is just delta over delta B. Small thing, but I think it will help keep people from getting confused. Possibly, I'm not sure. So finally, if you're in the theorist, if you are in this broad resonance limit, I ask the nomenclatures, please avoid quoting your results in the sort of bare Hamiltonian units, because there are several different Hamiltonians that all give the same physics. And I say to the experimenters, the theorists are going to help us out here, let's meet them halfway. And I'd like to suggest quoting your detuning in particular units of 1 over KFA. The theorists can do this, the experimenters can do it. It has very nice properties. It's this quantity is linear in delta B near the resonance. There's no cusp. If you have an uncertainty in where your resonance field is, it's simply an offset in your x-axis. It's easy to plot. And all the interesting physics of the sort of whole crossover stuff happens for 1 over KFA, kind of near between minus 2 or 2. It's a number not far from 1. And for the experimenters, look, I'm still an experimenter. I know that it's always better to plot your original data in raw units because we're experimenters, but you can come up with a supplementary plot to show to the theorists and to the people at talks that include this sort of reach out to the theorists, experimenters reach out to the theorists, theorists reach out to the experimenter type units. All right, so that's the consensus. I think almost all the theorists in this room would agree with that. Almost everything on that list, we'll find out in just a second when I stop. But I then want to sort of say, let's move on to some other questions. Questions like, more quantitatively, what does the pair wave function look like? For instance, near 1 over KFE equal minus 1, which, by the way, is about as far out from the resonance into the BCS limit as the experimenters have now gotten, is the size of this pair larger or smaller than the interatomic scattering length? Dynamical effects, in my personal opinion, and Alan and I may disagree, are really cool. Can one actually ramp a big Cooper pair into a molecule? Can ramps and jumps of the detuning tell us about microscopic and macroscopic physics? What about transient coherent oscillations in the order parameter? In bosons, in Wyman's group, he's been able to show that you can actually get a coherent oscillation between molecules and atoms. Can you do similar sorts of things in this crossover region in the Fermi system? How do we understand RF spectroscopy? We've learned, Jin's group showed us you can use RF spectroscopy to measure the binding energy of molecules. Rudy Grimm showed us a very, very exciting result that you can extend this out into the crossover region and measure some sort of thing going on in of perhaps the order parameter here. But it, you know, can we use this to understand the superconducting gap, the pair-forming gap, beta, pair structure even, if we look at the spectroscopy? I think this is something which theorists can really give us some good help on. Collective modes. Rudy Grimm suggested something interesting might happen when the gap is getting comparable to the frequency of the trap. How about finite temperature? There's important lessons from the boson case, the case of BEC, where we know that in BEC we discover that there are shifts in the frequency which are functions of A and T, temperature, which can be large compared to these shifts in frequency which we think of as many body shifts, the Na cubed type shifts. How can we understand all that? Do we need a three-fluid model for instance, in sound and collective oscillations? In helium, we've got a two-fluid model, which gives us second sound. In Bose-Einstein condensation, we've got a condensate and a normal component. And in finite temperature oscillations, we see these components oscillating sometimes at different frequencies and different phases. And if we do have a three-fluid model for atoms, for non-condensed pairs and for condensed pairs, can we use observations of oscillations and of sound of second, third, and 19th sound to tell us as a signature for preformed pairs? What about beta? I did not understand. I don't think there exists a consensus about beta. What do the different measurements actually probe? What is the Boltzmann limit, which everyone talks about? Surely it can't mean temperature very large compared to the Fermi energy, where I'm sure beta must go to zero. What happens when T goes to zero? I think this is stuff which remains unconsensed about. Oh, maybe not.
They published work on so-called beta, that is a vigorous result that we resolved.
TC over TF, we have a lesson from the boson case. For dilute bosons and condensation, the temperature, critical temperature in a trap is a function of number. Total number depends on the trap and the mean field. But the critical temperature is a function of the density at the center of the trap does not. Basically, the effect of the trap and mean field changes just changes the density here, and in that way changes the critical temperature. Is there a similar thing going on with fermions? We've heard it said that the critical temperature is at delta B equals zero is 0.25 in free space, 0.50 in a trap. Is this the same story in the sense that we're basically just the mean field is changing the density down there, and if we were to express the critical temperature as a function of the Fermi temperature is evaluated at the density in the center of the trap, and the Fermi and the critical temperature is evaluated at the density in the center of the trap, would you get the same result now for free space and for trap? And then finally, thermometry is really hard for the experimenters. Can theorists do calculations to help experimenters with their thermometry problem? The interesting physics happens in here, sort of between 1 over KFA of about minus 3 and 3. The Jin group does their thermometry by going way out into the negative side here and measuring a weakly interacting Fermi gas where you can measure T over TF. The lithium guys are going on the other side and they measure a weakly interacting Bose condensation, so they measure T over TBEC. You can use both of these to determine the entropy per particle. Then you ramp isoentropically in. So an interesting many-body region. S over N is known, but the experimenters have no idea how to measure T or TF with both, you know, the mean field changes the density in the middle. Theorists, I suggest, if you really want to do quantitative comparisons with experimenters, try, instead of calculating things like TC over TF, calculate the critical entropy per particle over TF, and this way you can actually compare with things that people are measuring. Okay, all done. So there's a consensus. Everyone agrees with that, right?
Yes.
Comments? Questions?
I want to just answer your question 6, which is the one about fusion of fear in the scale of the same value as the density. I think most of it is the same.
Say it again.
Can you show your question 6 again, Harry?
Yeah. It's been said a couple times today that the critical temperature is a function of the Fermi temperature at the delta B equals zero depends on whether you're in free space or in the trap. And perhaps this is only, if instead of expressing the critical temperature if you express the critical temperature divided by the Fermi temperature as a critical temperature at the density in the center of the trap divided by the Fermi temperature, which of course is just n to the 2/3, where it's a density in the center of the trap, is maybe this factor now no longer care about whether you're in the free space or in the trap. And Tony says, yes, this is the local density, and but it wasn't clear from the earlier conversations that this is what people were saying. If that's all they're saying, then we can cross 6 off the list. Well, I don't know. People certainly told me that it was 0.25. I'm talking exactly. No, I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about delta B equals zero. Is there at least consensus that the trap doesn't matter?
Oh, no. There is consensus. There is a statement that the trap matters. Where is Alan Greer?
Yeah. I have a question. You have to point five. How do you get to the third year?
Sorry?
When, by the time you get into unitarity region, you're usually very close to the maximum value of TC. If you just look at various calculations that people have done.
But the consensus is that the trap doesn't matter if you express it in terms of a central density. Is the consensus that whether you're in free space or the trap, it doesn't really change the critical temperature as long as you're expressing the critical temperature as a function of the central density and not as a total number of atoms in the trap.
It's a question of what TF you use.
Let's get uniform gas at a certain depth, fixed depth, and then calculate Pc divided by Tf. Yes. Okay. Then I take a trap gas with the same density in the center of the trap as was in the uniform case, and calculate the ratio Pc divided by T barrel. So what this is with barrel?
I'll get back to you.
That was an interesting observation. Initially, when we did basically the fact that
TC, for instance, is, you know, in the BEC limit approaches 0.5 is simply, of course, Einstein's formula, the cube root of the total number of atoms to times h bar omega zero, and then expressing h bar omega zero in terms of TF, and that's how you get 0.518. Now, the thing is, it depends on the total number of atoms. You're suggesting, and Eric's suggesting, it's somehow related to the density at the center of the trap. And it might be true, but I guess I haven't...
That is certainly what I'm suggesting.
Everybody here seems to be agreeing, so I'll agree too.
Yeah, it's consensus.
Okay.
It will be a very short comment. Actually, I want to thank you for the summary. I think it was a great summary. I disagree with one point only.
Oh, no.
It's really small. In the case of narrow resonances, I think one should use explicitly two channels, because otherwise one wouldn't be able to describe the momentum, magnetic moment of the state.
For the magnetic moment, you're correct.
That's the only criticism I have to
you. You'll never get the magnetic moment right unless you have got another channel with another magnetic moment. But how about this? Does everyone think this is all right here? This is the two-body physics. This is Anne. No problems here? Okay. We all agree. We can get along.
I have one comment and one question. I think if the first one is about TC, right? If the trap, the confining potential is very smooth over the coherence lens, then we are basically in the adiabatic limit. I don't see a difficulty to define a local TC in that case. And I would say that if that's the case, the TC will certainly depend on the density everywhere. And if you decrease the temperature, probably the center part will become BCS first, with certain proximity factor at the edge, extended over coherence lens, etc. That's the picture I can think about. If the confining potential is very abrupt over the coherence scale, then that's a different story. I don't know the answer. The second thing is, I have a question. I mean, how to think about the difference between the broad limit and the narrow limit right at the alpha equal to infinite? Any theorist here working on the problem can help me.
At the
resonance, yeah, the scattering lens is equal to infinite limit.
It's somehow I haven't been clear.
what's the difference?
whether you're in the broad or the narrow is not a function of your detuning. It's a function of the Feshbach resonance. If you're in a broad limit, the shape of the bound state is quadratic up through this Fermi energy, like this, right away up, all the way up there. That's the, and if you're in the narrow one, it's linear coming up here. It's not broad or narrow. Is it the tuning? It has to do with the shape of the two-body physics. That's what makes it broad or narrow.
In Bose limit, do you believe that there's a universal behavior, right, at the so-called unit? No?
No, this is this is the broadest universal.
Yeah, that's what I understand. Yeah. And the other one, Jason told me over lunch, that's not universal.
Yeah.
And so, but the
not,
universal...
By the way, not universal does not mean bad. Can we all agree on that?
I know.
I know there are some condensed matter theorists here who would disagree.
but not universal means right at alpha equal to infinite. Besides Fermi energy, that's the second energy scale. Is that the right way to think about it? If that's the case, what's the second energy scale I should think about?
Yeah. What he says.
Oh, you mean the decay, right?
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
Fine.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Other questions?
Yes. Chris.
Yes. I don't need the microphone.
All right. So, Eric, according to what you said, what do we have to think about the narrow resonance? Is the Virchow stuff correct for the narrow resonance or it's not?
Well, in Stoff's paper, he talks about this thing going as 1 over a squared.
Yes.
Which is a broad resonance idea.
Yes.
But he talks about the magnetic moment going changing very dramatically, which is a narrow resonance idea.
Okay.
My opinion is that Stoff's paper is internally inconsistent.
So, what do we have to think? What do I have to think? Is it correct or not?
Well,
okay.
I mean,
silence.
Gentlemen, ladies, Pang is not here.
Yes, yeah. Good okay. Point. Thank you.
So, I think what Eric said is, I think we agree on that.
Yes, well, that is we're always
I just wanted to comment on this question of if you could show the last slide again.
Which one is that last one? Temperature one?
Or anything with a Feshbach, with the energy.
No, I got
with the energy. This sort of thing. Just the point that down here, one doesn't really have a priori ideas about what this slope should be, in the sense the coupling between the various channels is very strong, and so it's not just the magnetic moment associated with, say, the channels that couple with the central part of the interaction, because of the...
Yeah, once we get way out here, eventually the behavior depends on your actual atomic system. Yeah, it's true.
Since Chris is up, can I ask Chris a question? Yeah. Could you comment on Morrill's comments yesterday that hacking the work of
I think we decided that we all just could get along. That was the whole point of this, is saying we actually think we're all saying the same thing. This wasn't a session for recriminations. This was a session for unity.
No, I think I should talk to Oral first.
Just ask a general question, which has been worrying me for a bit. Let's consider two different types of Feshbach resonance. They differ in the following way. In case one, which I suspect is the one that we actually encounter in all the experiments to date, one of the single atom states involved in the two channels is always the same. It's -9/2, -9/2, or whatever, and it's the other one is different, right? In the second type of Feshbach resonance, which may be purely imaginary for all I know, both the states of both atoms are different in the two channels. So for example, we could have in one of them 9/2 -9/2 and 9/2 -7/2, and then the other one we might have, I don't know, 7/2 -7/2 and 7/2 -5/2, whatever. Is this an important distinction? Do we need to bear in mind the sort of counting problem between the open and closed channels when we do this analysis?
I, Yeah, so it's possible to, there exist these two kinds of, could this go up a second?
Yeah.
So I think what Tony is saying is that typically in Feshbach resonance, you can have a sort of situation where, say, you start off with two atoms in, we'll break these up into different levels of M level, two F equal one atoms like this, and the crossing is between a one of these atoms then is a molecule in which one of these atoms is actually in the F equal two state, so you're kind of in, if this is, say, whatever it is, 5 gigahertz for your favorite atom, you're actually looking, your closed channel is actually a bound state which is bound by 5 gigahertz. You could actually imagine also another sort of Feshbach resonance where your closed channel involves two different atoms, both of your atoms in the F equal two, and now basically this is up here by 10 gigahertz, and now you have a much more deeply bound state. I mean, if this more deeply bound state is going to be that much smaller, everything else being equal, the coupling is going to be correspondingly weaker. And it may be, for instance, that the coupling is so much weaker that the more simple case is going to be a broad Feshbach resonance, and the more deeply bound case will be a narrow Feshbach resonance. In that case, they'll be dramatically different. But I would guess that's the main and maybe only difference. Counting problem. I don't think so.
I think there's huge experimental, if I can comment on what Eric's saying there, because we discussed, Ohashi and I discussed this in a recent rejected paper. but for instance, in a composite sort of boson type or Cooper pair BCS type of theory I was mentioning, where you have the Cooper pair part, that's the background part, and then you have a G boson type thing like this. In these fermion boson problems, of course, one doesn't really, even though one talks about it as closed channel and pays obedience or obeyance or whatever it is to the AMO people, one just simply says it's a molecule. But then if you think of what that molecule is, the question is, let me call these open, okay? The Cooper pair is made out of two atoms in the open channel, spin up and spin down, actually, okay? But they're involved with the open atoms. In contrast, the question is, what is this molecule corresponding to? Is it, I mean, relevant to what Eric's, or I think Tony was just discussing, is that if we had a theory, which is not necessary, but if we had a theory now of what this molecule is it something like this, too? Let me create this. Is it something like this? That is, it does involve the open channel?
Yes.
Or, in which case does it involve this? The strong resonance?
The broad case.
The broad case. Yeah. Okay. Well, I think it has great experimental significance, and probably one can check that, because if in RF spectroscopy you break up this molecule, as Debbie, for instance, does, and what have you, then the atoms you get out will be the C up guys and the C down guys, and they're now part of a, say, BCS superfluid, and as a result, they're going to be affected. For instance, these guys will have a single particle spectrum, which is BCS-like, with an energy gap. In contrast, if, for instance, maybe this atom might involve, I don't know, maybe an open down and, let's say, a closed up, just to take an example, and you break this atom up, then you're going to get a C0 atom coming out, but and that will certainly, these are open, that will certainly have an energy gap that is given by the BCS spectrum, as pointed out by Leggett in 1980, but for instance, the atom in the closed channel will presumably not have that energy gap. In other words, it makes a big distinction, and I think the RF spectroscopy approach is a very rich experimental technique, which up till now has not, I think, been really used to study the dynamics when you break up this molecule.
I hope it will be, but Rudy and Debbie can correct me if I'm wrong, but I actually believe that they usually do their RF spectroscopy into yet a third channel, which has nothing to do with any of the other channels, and which is completely unoccupied, and so that there's no...
Is that right?
Yeah.
But that, in any event, it's interesting when you use the RF spectroscopy and break it up. Whether you break it up in atoms, the spin up and spin down atoms or not, they will have quite a different single particle spectrum. And I'm going to take this opportunity to correct the statement, which somehow I must have said, because everybody says I said it, but I certainly didn't reject dynamics. I think dynamics is great. But, for instance, studying the properties of atoms in the system, their energy and momentum, studying collective modes is great. But all that is what I call linear response theory, the excitations of a system originally in equilibrium. The ramping problem is a different sort of business. It involves very rich physics, complex physics, because it's what I call non-equilibrium physics. And that's a different regime than dynamics. There's dynamics, and there's non-equilibrium. Non-equilibrium is great, but first get the linear response part clear, and I don't think we got that clear.
Did you get an answer to Alex's question, or consensus answer? Is there a different color in that
The consensus answer is no, it's the same color boson.
All right, I think we need to move on.
Maybe one comment which I think is important. Well, when this is the Feshba resonance, we have some line which is a resonance, a virtual state. In the case of a narrow resonance, it may be a molecular state in the singlet channel. But maybe I should point out, looking at several theories, which to some extent disagree, or if people have criticized Henk Stoof's theory, but I think all those theories have in common that there is some level which continues, whether it's a virtual state, whether it's a scattering resonance, whether it's another molecule, and how to describe it, there may be some controversy. But there's one thing I find important to point out, that when this is the Fermi energy, we have this dashed line which moves through the Fermi energy. And at the moment when this level leaves the Fermi energy, this is the region where KFA equals 1. So we should be aware that the strong coupling region, the region where a lot of interesting physics happens, is really characterized by that there is some dashed line within the range of the Fermi energy. And I'm curious, and I personally don't know the answer, when different theories write down something. Maybe there is a term which simply characterizes this dashed line. This dashed line may be part of the complete dynamics of the fermions, but if we make approximations, at least as an experimentalist, I could imagine that it makes some sense to use some approximations here, but first take out this dashed line and treat it separately. I don't think as an experimentalist that this is necessarily a different channel, and I don't know what colors to put on it, but I just want to point that out, that we have this dashed line. It has a meaning either as a virtual state or as a scattering state, and I think some theorists have treated this dashed line as a separate entity. Whether this is a powerful approximation scheme or something which is wrong, I think there is some dispute about it.
I haven't really quite understood Wolfgang's comment. Well, since I wasn't involved in many of these theories, I think I'm also a disinterested party. Are you asking? I don't know what you're asking. Are you asking that? No, I don't know what you're asking. You're saying that this line is interesting. We should think about it and whether theory had made a mistake. I don't quite understand.
The Stoof theory, that line corresponds to when you start forming molecules.
Well, when you said what I was asking, I made a statement which I thought is common consensus, that there is, Eric showed these bandwidths, other people show different lines, but there is something, a line, a dashed line, a solid line, which cuts through the Fermi energy, and that the strong coupling region is characterized by when this line exits this band of Fermi energies. So that the strong coupling region is characterized by some virtual scattering state, whatever, embedded into the Fermi C. And that's a common denominator which I've seen in many theorists. But what name to put on this dashed line and what its physical significance is, I think there is disagreement. So it wasn't a question, I think it was trying to summarize where I see some consensus and where I see some open questions.
I can't give a name.
From the point of view of the two-body physics, it's not a particularly, through the middle of that band, there is a particular spot at which, for a given magnetic field and a given incoming scattering energy, the scattering amplitude goes to its unitarity limit, and that line sort of traces up like that. It's sort of like the almost like the absolute magnitude of the line coming in from the other direction, but it's not from the two-body physics point of view. It's not a particularly interesting place, but there is a line that does sort of go like a squared coming up like that.
Well, I want to comment on this because I think it's very important. Is that in this whole subject, one is sort of discussing in some sense, trying to go originally from the two-body physics, which I think there's a consensus on, to the many-body physics in combination with the two-body physics. And essentially, I would say this point that Kennerly has done, and I have to say that it's in our PRL a couple of years ago, that basically, but it's first, as Wolfgang pointed out, soon as a molecule can be created, which essentially is that line going across, right? Soon as, even in the resonant state, as soon as it can be created, you can start forming molecules. So rather than saying the Feshbach resonance in the many-body system is relevant, namely when the binding energy is equal to 1 over A is 0, the thing is the effective point where molecules are created is precisely where when the binding energy of this resonant state equals to 2 EF. That's the real many-body.
All right.
And in fact, the original two-body criteria is no longer really particularly important. I think experimentalists
have to... quarter out, and then we're going to cut this off.
You see, I don't think I'm very good at reaching consensus, so I apologize for that, but I'll try to be short. I think there is a meaning, you see, to that particular line, and what it means is the following. When you think in terms of a single channel, which I think is the right picture in the case of broad resonance, you have to specify for the two-body wave function the boundary condition at the origin, where you start, and the scattering length simply defines that. In the particular case, when you reach exactly the Feshbach resonance, the two atoms emerge from the interaction region with zero relative momentum. This is the slowest they can be. Otherwise, they exit out with a momentum which is at the order of the inverse of the radius of the interaction. So I think this is the meaning of that.
Okay.
Okay, I think I will tend to agree with that. So the scatterness essentially is a wave function at origin. Okay, I think that's the reason why the resonance for the lithium 6 at 837 Gauss is so broad. Okay, that the amplitude near the origin is very, very large. And just because it's so broad, I think in fact we can think about the whole system in a different point of view. Okay, say, if you look at the binding energy calculation near the resonance, in fact the Bell state is about 800 megahertz above the continuum. Okay, the Bell state is very, very far away from the continuum, and simply because there's a background scattering is minus 2000 A naught. So that means the scattering phase shift is very, very close to pi over 2. You only need additional very, very small contribution from the virtual coupling to a Feshbach state, then you can increase the phase shift to pi over 2, then you create a Feshbach resonance at this field. Okay. Otherwise, the crossing, the Bell state cross the continuum at something like 550 Gauss or something. Okay, right. So, like in terms of the formalism, I think probably one consistent way to include into the Hamiltonian would be the Feshbach resonance coupling will always be open channel to closed channel coupling. Okay, while the this kind of virtual coupling can really change the width of the resonance. Okay, the width of resonance in fact is determined by the background scatteredness, which is in, which is independent of the phase-bar coupling. Okay, at least, well, there are two factors into the scatteredness near the resonance. One would be the background scatteredness. The other one would be the coupling between the closed channel and open channel. Okay.
I just want to ask Eric this question again, because I think you perhaps gave different answers for that. If you raise the blackboard, Ellen wrote down this B, yes? Within either single channel or two channel theory, this B molecular field is constructed from C spin up and C spin down. But when molecular is breaking up, actually it is breaking up not to C spin up or spin down, but it's breaking up into D up or D down or something, other states. Is that right?
Are we talking about the RF spectroscopy experiments?
Yeah.
You should ask Debbie and Rudy. I mean, they do. My understanding is that, yeah, they actually go to an entirely different state, which okay. has no occupation.
Okay.
Need to move on. Tony wanted to make some comments, I'm told, on the superfluid density. That's fine.
You just picked up. Yeah, you picked up my
Does anybody have a transparency? Here, let me put this on you.
I thought it was probably just worthwhile to just spend a couple of minutes making some trying to clarify some points about the notion of the condensate fraction, in particular in the BCS limit. I guess if you start from the the BEC end, there's really no problem, because essentially all definitions of the condensate density, at least at zero temperature, come out to be the same. You've got for a Freeboes gas, you've got 100% of your atoms in the condensate, and the and also the superfluid density, which is, as it were, the fraction of the liquid which flows with a velocity determined by the condensate, is also 100%. Now, if you now go to the Fermi end, the first distinction you obviously have to make is between the superfluid density and the condensate fraction. The superfluid density, again, can be defined as the amount of the liquid which basically flows in an irrotational way. I guess that's one possible definition. I should say that the notion of superfluidity is actually not that unambiguous, and not all the phenomena which we normally class under the behavior of superfluid necessarily go together, but I think that's a relatively simple definition. If one takes that definition and one is in free space, then there's a general belief, at least, that at zero temperature, the superfluid density is simply equal to the total density. In other words, the superfluid fraction is one. I don't personally think that that's all that obvious, and I've actually written a paper precisely devoted to just that point, but at least it is the general belief, and I don't know of any counterexamples. Now, we don't want to define that. We want to, particularly in the context of recent experiments, we're more interested in a somewhat different definition of the condensate density. It seems to me the most natural definition at the BCS end, we are talking, remember, only about definitions, the most natural definition is simply as the maximum eigenvalue of the two-particle density matrix. That sounds a bit abstract, but in the BCS limit, this is just the same as what is usually called the off-diagonal average, psi dagger of R, psi dagger down of R, evaluated at the same point, squared. It's basically that that quantity. And if you take that definition, then what you find is that the typically in under BCS conditions, this as a fraction of the total number of particles is, if we call that the condensed fraction, then that is of the order of Tc over Tf, which is typically much less than one in the BCS limit. So even that's true even at zero temperature. Now, the question is, is there some other definition of the condensate fraction which would be more directly relevant to the kind of experiments, in particular the sweep experiments which have been recently conducted? And I have not been able to find one which does not in the end simply reduce effectively to the superfluid density. The most obvious candidate is the following. As Kathy pointed out, the BCS wave function can be written in the form V dagger K, A dagger K up, A dagger minus K down, acting on zero. And this then has the property that either both the states, K up and minus K down, are occupied, or neither of them is. And therefore it's tempting at first sight to think, well, couldn't we define some kind of condensate fraction, let's say F tilde C, as simply sum over K, N K up, N minus K down, normalized to the total number here. Problem with that, unfortunately, is that this has a very large value, essentially almost one, even in the normal phase, in the degenerate limit. Now, if one doesn't want to do that, then if one wants to take a definition which in some sense reflects the degree of Cooper pairing and is not simply equivalent to this, then I think you've got to, in some sense, weight this with some kind of temperature factor. And this is precisely what the original Landau definition of the superfluid density does, because that is simply 1 minus, so rho s, according to Landau, in a system of weakly interacting quasiparticles, is just 1 minus n to the minus 1, I've probably got the factors wrong, but integral df by dE, where this is the Fermi function. This does have the nice characteristic that it's zero in the normal phase at any temperature, and at zero temperature in the superfluid phase, it reduces to one. And I strongly suspect that if we really want, as I say, we are talking here only really about matters of definition, but if we want a definition which is in some sense going to capture the essence of what we're trying to infer in these sweep experiments, then we want something which is pretty close to this in the long run. That's all I really wanted to say. Yeah.
I have a couple of questions here. I guess I'm not going to today. Because if I, that integral, one can compute the way you've written it.
Yes.
It seems to be equal to 1.
This is, sorry, my writing is not very clear. This is a capital E, which is...
That's better.
Yeah.
Okay. But I do have a question concerning the first quantity, though.
This one here?
I think that particular quantity is ill-defined. For example, if I'll take, I don't think this is on, but probably I'm loud enough. I think, for example, if I'll take a simple model like pairing interaction is zero range, that quantity depends on the cutoff which I'm going to put it there, and therefore, you see, because it contains the cutoff, it's somewhat unphysical, and I don't think it's related to the physics of the problem, because it's some high energy scale which shouldn't reflect actually the many body character of the condensate we are looking at. So for that reason, I think, you see, from that quantity one should remove somehow this high energy component and leave only the many body component in some way to have the regularized quantity instead, which will be linked to the gap in the end.
Yeah, can I just comment on that? You're absolutely right, of course. If I assume a simple contact potential, then let me write this out in momentum space notation. It's something like, if I call correctly, sum of a k. Something wrong with this, what I've just said, I think. We want something which looks, I think I really should have this, in fact. And then I think, I believe it becomes this, and that is convergent, even in the BCS. Yes, yeah.
I probably want to make another proposal, and I want to ask Tony if that's equivalent to your definition. So a straightforward way to look at the two particle density of state in the case space perhaps is introduce an operator which involve so let me call it, this is the Cooper pair number in the Q channel creation operator.
So is this supposed to be an expectation value?
I just introduced this
operator.
Okay. Yeah. And then, similar to what we did for one particle density of matrix, I look at a quantity like this in my condensate state. And let me call this is number of Cooper pairs in channel Q. The BCS state constructed in this way with no supercurrent flowing in the system seems to suggest that all pairs actually in this Q equal to zero channel. So if I introduce a parameter which is similar to Onsaga Penrose parameter, which called Q equal to zero Cooper channel, and then divided by all the Cooper pairs in all different sum of all Q. If this is equal to 1, does it imply that all particles condensed or not? Is it equivalent definition or it's very different one?
Somehow I don't know. I mean, the trouble I had with this is that my instinct tells me that this quantity is going to be non-zero even when you have no Cooper pairing at all.
I just wanted to suggest that I think that we should focus on experiments. What experiment really probes the density of Cooper pairs, the number of Cooper pairs? And I also wanted to comment that one of the mystery about something you said before, one of the mysteries of the high temperature cuprate superconductors is that at zero temperature in the cuprates, the number of electrons is not equal to the number of is not related to the number of Cooper pairs in the underdoped cuprates. So that's an example of a superfluid that violates that. Maybe you disagree.
I think I disagree with that. The superfluid density in the underdoped regime is not equal to the total.
That's what
density.
I meant to say. The superfluid density.
Okay, but it's very important to I think to make that distinction.
Yes, and it's because it's not translationally invariant, the system.
Yeah.
Possibly.
Okay, I think we'll move on.
Sure.
Another possibility would be to look at the two body correlation function.
Okay.
Which would be something like and there are some maps and down. So now, if we look at, say, one, these are the two particles, one and one prime, so let's call this R. And then we have other two, one more pair, so two to prime. And let's call these are prime. Yeah. And this is instead of the distance between the center and the centers of mass.
Yeah.
Then if we look at this function, when r becomes much larger than r and r prime, then, basically, the BC limit, this, this quantity would go to something that it's the condensate fraction.
I think actually you have your ones, your indices mixed up, but at least I would have put them the other way around. But basically, you're just giving the Yang, the essentially Yang's definition of the degree of long range order. Yes.
Times phi star of r phi of r prime.
Yeah.
Why? So this is the BEC limit. Yeah. While the BCS limit.
Yeah.
This would go to delta of r prime star. Now, I remember that there's Emmanuel here, Emmanuel Bloch. Anyway, I remember that in the BEC, for BEC systems, zoning systems, so there was a nice experiment done in Munich where they were looking at the R to infinity, so size of the trap, decay of the corresponding correlation function to this in the bosonic case, and they were looking at, so this was in the case of the presence of the condensate, of course this was going to a finite value that was the condensate fraction.
Yeah.
So this could be, I don't know whether this systems is experimentally doable, but
Yeah, great. I think essentially what you've given is the Yang definition. What I've given is the Penrose-Onsager definition. And the two, under most circumstances, and certainly in translation invariant systems, the two generally speaking coincide. In a trap geometry, as you say, you have the problem that your trap actually has a finite size, and that's why I prefer not to use the Yang definition there. But I agree, I think conceptually it's the same. Except I would I think I think you mislabeled your indices.
In that case, that wouldn't be the density,
Well, it's simply that the single particle wave functions would be falling off, you see. I mean, it's a sort of trivial point, but one, if you're going to use the Yang definition in its original form, then you do need, I think, a translation invariant system. Otherwise,
Okay. Sandra wanted to report something briefly.
I guess it's a Monte Carlo result.
So here I would like to give a very short contribution to the discussion about the broad resonance scenario. And this is the result of a numerical simulation. These results are still preliminary and have been carried out by Stefano Giorgini and Gregory Astrakarnic in Trent in collaboration with the people in their collaborators in Barcelona. So this is the simplest potential that one can consider. It's a square wave potential, attractive. Well, at zero is the fixes the range of the interaction. This is supposed to be very small compared to the average distance between particles. And in this calculation, they fixed this choice for the, let's say, for the range of the potential. Then, using this two-body interaction, they carried out a Monte Carlo calculation, and this is based on a diffusion Monte Carlo approach, in which one starts from a trial wave function, which is built by anti-symmetrizing a product of pair functions, and these pair functions correspond to the to each of one to the solution, the exact solution to body Schrödinger equation with this potential. So, for a given value of the depth of the potential, one has a very defined, well-defined value of the scattering length. And this wave function here is associated with this scattering length, and so it corresponds to the molecule, the dimer, with the corresponding value of the scattering length. Then this wave function here is not the wave function where one calculates the energy. This is the trial wave function from which one starts to carry out the diffusion Monte Carlo approach, which provides the lowest energy solution having the same nodes associated with this wave function here. Sorry? This is exactly the BCS wave function, but this is not the wave function that at the end is calculated. This is the starting wave function. And from this, the diffusion Monte Carlo will bring the system into the best wave function with the same nodes.
What's the wave function?
Sorry?
What's the wave function
for the scattering length? No, this is, these results are for positive scattering length. No, they have developed the method of negative, but here I will report mainly with the positive scattering length.
I'm sorry, I'm looking at the GPU question. Functions,
the solution
of the normal system in the web, or if they are
the BCS solution, say? No, this is...
So you're just asking the
problem. Sorry. You take this as initial wave function. You could choose also a different tri-wave function. You could take a slater determinant of plane waves, for example. It matters, of course, because the nodes are different, very different, and then so the final solution can be different in terms of energy, and because this is, for Fermi systems, the diffusion Monte Carlo doesn't provide the exact ground state energy, but provides the lowest energy with the fixed choice for the nodes of the wave function, and so that's different.
Cause confusion, since somebody asked you whether this was your initial trial.
This is the initial trial.
BCS. It's actually the initial one is PVC. Okay. In the sense that the phi, that's what Marilu was saying, the phi, you know, in BCS, you know, involves using these and what have you.
Okay. No, this is.
That is a trial. This is.
If you like. It's a product of chaos. So this is the way for this can be.
No.
Marilu, this is can be a Yukawa wave function, too, very similar to Yukawa at large distances. And then at short distances, it's fixed by the explicit form of the potential. So the diffusion Monte Carlo gives at the end the value for the energy, and the results that they have obtained are shown here. So these are plotted in the way that Eric likes. So it's a function of KFA. And this is the energy calculated with this Monte Carlo approach minus the binding energy of a molecule, which is 1 over a square for small a, of course. And this is calculated as a function of this parameter. And there are two interesting points that emerge from this calculation. First, they are able to identify the value of the energy in a unitarity point, and the result that you obtain is 0.4, which means that beta is minus 0.6, which corresponds to a slightly lower value compared to the Carlson-Pandari-Pandai simulation, but not very different. In that calculation, the value for beta is minus 55, point, I think, no?
The number here, either 42 or 44, plus minus.
Okay, this is, in any case, this is very, so this is very close. In fact, the technique is very similar. The procedure is slightly different. The trial wave function is very different. What's interesting is that with this procedure, you emphasize very much the molecular nature of the mini body wave function. And so this is very well suited to study the extreme molecular BC regime. And in fact, what's interesting, that of course not only one gets the correct value for the binding energy of the molecules, but when you subtract from the total energy, the molecular binding energy, you can plot the resulting energy as a function of 1 over KFA, and one finds that the equation of state follows exactly the Gross-Peter-Jeschow Bogoliubov density dependence, and with the scattering length, which is very well in agreement with the value 0.6. And so here, is the amplification of this region. Well, one can see that if one takes the equation state for a mean field with the scattering length equal 0.6, one fits very well the data of the Monte Carlo calculation. So from this point of view, this simulation confirms from a more on a microscopic basis, many body basis, the results of Petrov et al., and at the same time provides the full expression for the energy, at least for positive scattering lengths. I know that they obtained also value for negative scattering lengths, but I cannot discuss. Yeah, in fact, they have. They are now able to explore also the negative scattering length side. The question, in that case, I have to change the nature of the two-body, the pair for the correlation function, the pair function that enters the trial wave function. I cannot discuss more about this because I am not out of these things. So it's just to report the results. They have changed the trial wave function. What I know that they are able to reproduce the BCS limit, where they reproduce the Fermi energy plus the mean field interaction with the positive scattering length. It's negative,
of course. The first Monte Carlo that we have seen produced the 0.6A, as far as I know. Okay, so I think it's very good.
This is, yeah. So this reinforces the consensus about the picture in the broad resonance regime, where we have the unitarity limit and the molecule-molecule interaction, which is renormalized with respect to the value.
Say that the energy you get
agrees with
the Bobby
Lee, the Yang Lee. No. This is not beyond the mean field.
Yeah.
This is the mean field term. So it's the term linear, the one that we have in Gospitaleschi theory.
Yeah. So that agrees very well right up to minus one.
Yes. So starting from this, one could explore, but this is not easy, whether there are this beyond mean field effect here. I think that this will be very hard to see, but in any case, if one wants to take the microscope point of view, this can be the
case.
Works so well.
Oh, I'm asking
That's true, yeah. I want simply to mention that there is a similar calculation which was posted something like a couple of weeks ago on physics by Pandari Pandey's group, and they also trace the entire curve. But I think there is more to that because they compute both odd and even systems, so they extract the value of the pairing gap, which you don't have here. So I think that there is more information in that particular case. They seem to be a little bit lower, not significantly so, but it would be interesting to compare simply the slope of the equation of state near the unitarity limit, because that defines the shift in the frequency of the collective oscillations, which is a measurable thing.
Yes.
And there is a number coming from Pandari Pandey, and it's interesting how he compares with this. Those are equally universal numbers, I think.
Did they also calculate the positive energy?
Yes, both.
Did they calculate the neutrino 0.6a, the neutrino energy?
I don't know if they go that far as here, but they go pretty far.
Okay, I won't expect that we just didn't get to go that far.
That could be the interesting question is minus 1 to 1 as we agree.
I wanted to raise a question since this factor of 2 is associated with the simplest sort of Eagles-Schrieffer ground state, the ratio of the interboson to fermionic wave scattering length. This is somehow a hint that there's a better ground state, a more accurate ground state out there. And I want to get back to the question that Tony was trying to answer. Do we know something about, or could one determine whether this is incompletely condensed? Could we learn more about condensate fractions and such things?
Well, from this calculation, I think that one can calculate the two-body density matrix. So, for example, this microscopic ab initio calculation in the Bose case provided the one-body density matrix, and they calculate the condensate fraction. So one could calculate some long-range behavior in the two-body density matrix. I don't know, okay, if this is easy to do or not, but...
Actually, that's what is mentioned on the record. It's the way to calculate the quantity fraction in these relations. And you actually can also calculate
okay, we're going to move on. I guess Sabir wanted to say something.
Sorry, thank you. I just finished to add a comment. We are performing with the Stefania de Baum a similar calculation. But we are looking at the effect of the narrow versus broad resonance by using this wide barrier model for the interaction potential. And
all right, I thought I knew a little bit about Fishbach resonances, but after hearing Eric's discussion and all the atomic physics jargon, I realized I'm pretty ignorant, so go easy on me. I should also say this is work in collaboration with, sorry, that's not Yale, that's a typo, Hank Stoops group. And I refer all quite difficult questions to him, although with this audience, I'm not sure that's the right strategy. Anyway, so I'm going to tell you about some recent work with Hank and his group. And there's some very similar ideas by Leo Radziejowski that appeared around the same time. So I'm really here for the other workshop on exotic order. And I want to discuss this because I'd like to think this particular example of a system is one you have a simple realization of a more exotic order than has been discussed so far in BEC systems anyway. All right, so the question that's the central focus in a sense of the exotic order workshop is really the simple question, when you have a big system, infinite system, when are two quantum ground states of that system really distinct? Or another way to put the same question, if you have two states, can you connect them by an adiabatic evolution of some parameter in the Hamiltonian? So if you can, then they're really the same state at some fundamental level, although many of their energy scales may be quite different. But if you can't, then really there's a fundamental difference, and there should be a quantum critical point or a phase transition of some type in between them. Now, so we know examples of phases of matter where clearly there must be a quantum critical point between them. And the usual idea is some what I'll call conventional order parameter, usually associated with a broken symmetry. So when I go from a superfluid state to the high temperature state of Bose gas, I know there must be a phase transition in between because there was a broken symmetry associated with the conservation of total number of particles that's broken in the superfluid state. And magnetism is another example of this. But one of the focuses, one of the realizations that's emerged in the last decade or so, especially in the context of the quantum Hall effect and also in some work in the cuprates, is that there are more subtle kinds of order, which could be called quantum topological or exotic, depending on your favorite way of looking at it, which are important for quantum states. And these orders are not necessarily associated with broken symmetry, but they do indeed lead to distinct types of states with distinct types of excitations. So this particular example is kind of a baby version. It's not really that exotic, but it is of the type in the sense that in terms of the broken symmetry, if you looked at it, you would say, well, the two states are the same. Okay, so we've discussed a lot about Fermi systems, Fishbach resonance. And I believe I'm correct in stating that everyone agrees that as you change the due tuning for a Fermi system, then in both limits, the ground state, the many-body ground state, can be written in this BEC/BCS form of pairs, which are then anti-symmetrized over the constituents fermions. And this basic wave function applies in both states. And that's, of course, the fundamental reason why you can go smoothly from one end to the other. And so all we address for this corresponding question of what happens if the constituents were bosons and not fermions. Of course, the issues of stability of the system when you're boson is a lot more subtle, and I really want to address it. Other than saying at this point is that even if the two ends are meant as stable, these issues will be of relevance for experiments. Okay, so if I now take the same system with bosons, then can I write down simple wave functions in the opposite limits? Well, if you form molecules, well, then of course you want to take the symmetric combination of the molecules of the bosons. Whereas in this other end, rather than forming a BCS state, you just form an ordinary BC of atoms. And now these wave functions, these simple wave functions, really look completely distinct, at least just staring at it. And what we want, what I'm going to discuss is a way of formalizing the idea that these states are really distinct and they cannot be smoothly connected. Now, in fact, there's a very nice old paper by Nozier and St. James who were looking at this issue, and they did find in their calculation that, in fact, there was a sharp transition point, a thermodynamic singularity between these two limits. And what we've done in our recent work is really formalize that rather precisely, that independent of any approximation, there's definitely always at least one phase transition. And in fact, the phase transition is identified by an Ising order parameter. So there's just a plus minus 1 degree of freedom. And in fact, the critical exponents and all the fluctuations at the critical point will be that of the 3D Ising model, which are, of course, well known. All right, so how do we see this? So the simplest way to see this is, in fact, not to think about the wave function, but of the elementary excitations of the wave function in the two opposing limits. So if I start, let's see, maybe we've forgotten. So why are the two superfluids distinct? Well, let's start in the molecular case. So that's way in the left. Well, one set of excitations that you can create are vortices. And here I'm imagining, as a condensed matter theorist, that the bosons have charge E. So I'm measuring the flux associated with each vortex. If they're not charged, well, let's think of this as the quantum circulation. So there is an elementary vortex, which I'll say has circulation 1/2, in which, as you go around it, the phase of the molecule winds exactly by 2 pi. Now, that's the fundamental vortex you can create when you form a molecular superfluid. You can also form double vortices. These are metastable states. They'll, of course, split apart into two, but you can form them. And if you go around a double vortex, the phase of the molecular wave function will wind by 4 pi. Okay, and these are all stable states in the molecular superfluid, way to the left. Now let me ask the same question way to the right and ask what happens. So now I'm in an atomic superfluid. Now if I take this double vortex, a vortex with circulation 1, then the molecular wave function as you go around winds by 4 pi. And if you write on the corresponding, look at what would happen to a single atomic condensate, well, that'll wind by 2 pi, by half that of a molecule. And that's certainly okay. So this vortex is still allowed to exist. On the other hand, if I take the elementary vortex of the molecular state, then while phi m winds by 2 pi, this means that the wave function of the atomic condensate will wind by pi, so it'll change sign. And clearly, if the wave function changes sign, there's a huge energy cost. So in fact, in the atomic limit, there's a branch cut, if you wish. So there's some line which will connect these half vortices. And this line will have some energy, finite energy cost. So in fact, I will not be able to take this half vortex infinitely far away from this one. They're always bound to each other as long as there is an atomic condensate. So you see there's a discrete difference in the quantization of the elementary vorticity in the two limits. And so these cannot be smoothly connected, so there must be at least one phase transition in between, unlike the fermionic case. So the phase diagram you would then draw from these considerations is that on one limit you have a BEC of molecules, the other limit you have BEC of atoms. And over here the half vortices are free. On the other hand, the half vortices are confined in their limit, and this transition really is a confinement-deconfinement transition of vortices. So now I'm presenting it really as a confinement-deconfinement transition of excitations, but it's also a transition of the ground state. The wave function evolves non-analytically at this point, and in fact, you get a whole new set of low-energy excitations. These are effectively collective density modes that become critical at this point, And you can describe those fluctuations using what we know about the 3D Ising model. So it's a rather interesting realization of a highly non-trivial critical point in this system. Okay, so now of course the issue is, you know, can one do this in experiments? And we're well aware that one of the most difficult question is of course one of stability. You know, bosons with attraction tend to just collapse. But if you could somehow prevent the collapse, and one way to do that, you know, might be to imagine that you have some molecular scattering length that's large and positive. Anyway, so we take this kind of two-component theory of atoms and molecules and solve it in some Gaussian fluctuation approximation, some reasonable approximation, and this is the kind of phase diagram you get as a function of the detuning and temperature. So in this limit, you have just BEC of atoms. This is the BEC of molecules. So this sharp line is an artifact of the approximation. When you improve it by putting in damping, you only get smooth lines. But there is this phase transition line, that's the key one, and that's the Ising transition. And notice it happens on this side. So you don't even have to be in the positive side. You could start with the dilute gas of molecules and move it towards the Fechtbach resonance, and if you're lucky, we'll see this transition before things become really unstable. As long as meta is stable, there's a good chance of seeing this. So what are the signals? Well, of course, the direct way of saying it unambiguously was just to look for vortices in this BEC of molecules and seeing how the, you know, what happens to the vortices, whether they liberate apart or not. You could look at the density of atoms, free atoms, and this would have some non-analytic change at this point. And finally, most interestingly also, I think there will be, as I mentioned, critical fluctuations. So this is a strongly coupled critical point of the Ising order parameter, and this will feed into the damping of the collective modes. We'll have an extra damping, which will have a maximum at this point, presumably. And also it leads to a decay in the single atom Green's function. I'm not quite sure how you measure such a thing in the BEC experiment. Okay, well, thanks a lot.
We have time for a couple of questions or comments.
Actually, I tried to be very short because actually a proper comment will require essentially a talk.
Okay.
You see, once you go through the Fechtbach resonance in the boson case,
yeah,
you can't avoid Efimov type of physics.
Oh, what, sorry?
Efimov, three-body physics.
And that's
not taken into account here, and that leads to extremely important phenomena, and all those parameters which you write there, they are known. For example, the atom molecule scattering length goes through infinity an infinite number of times.
Atom
scattering length, it's negative.
Yeah.
However, three-body scattering length, for example, for three atoms, goes through infinities again an infinite number of times. So you have a number of instabilities there which are simply not taken into account in the simple Hamiltonian.
I don't disagree with anything you're saying. I don't disagree with the basic point. I mean, this is a phenomenological model, and I don't claim to know the underlying atomic physics as well as you do. Now, it's quite clear that, you know, there could be additional three-body effects that could make the molecule unstable here. It's possible. My own comment with all of those calculations are in free space, and we're really talking about a many-body system. And if you've got a many-body condensate of molecules, you have to ask, as a many-body state, when is that going to break apart? And one of the things that can happen in a second-order transition is this type of transition. All right.
So are you saying that the transition both at zero and finite temperature is of the Ising class?
At zero temperature, it's more complicated. Okay. Finite temperature is 3D Ising. At zero temperature, it's not just 4D Ising. Okay. It's a little more complicated than that.
I don't disagree with anything you say, but I would have thought it were rather a simpler way of looking at it. It might be simply that by the way you've defined your molecular condensate and your atomic condensate, the moment you form your molecular condensate, the largest eigenvalue of the one particle density matrix is no longer macroscopic. Yeah. And this raises, surely raises the interesting question, is it in fact possible, realistically, to have a state in which the, first the eigenvalue of the one particle density matrix is macroscopic, and at the same time, the eigenvalue of the two particle one is, in a non-trivial way, as it were, that is one which, crudely speaking, corresponds to molecules. So in other words, could you have a coexistence of atoms and...
This is a coexistence state. Both the eigenvalues are larger. It should really...
No, I'm not asking about the eigenvalues. I'm asking about the actual eigen... you're saying that the...
This has both an atomic... The existence of an atomic condensate implies a molecular...
Well, yes, I know in a sort of trivial way, but I mean... Yeah, but could you also have a condensate of something recognizable as molecules, which is not quite the same thing?
I'm not sure I understood that. What did you say?
If I just have a free Bose gas below its transition temperature, the one particle density matrix has a macroscopic eigenvalue, and trivially the two particle one does also, simply because, well, I can just put two bosons together. What is interesting though is, could I have bound pairs of atoms which form diatomic molecules, could they have a large eigenvalue simultaneously with the single atoms having one? I think that's not a trivial question, is it?
I'm not sure there's any distinction. I mean, there's only there's either a one-atom condensate or a two-atom condensate or both. There's really no fundamental distinction in the sense of smoothly connected states between the two.
Okay. Well, I think I disagree. Maybe there's a technical point.
I don't think there is a distinction. Yeah.
When does this transition occur? It occurs at the negative scattering length. At the negative value of the scale?
No, this is positive. Positive on this side.
Okay, so because I see the sign minus.
That's the detuning.
Okay. So it occurs at the positive.
Yes.
How positive it is? What is Ka characteristic?
Okay, well, we should work that out. Or I don't know. there's no question that such a transition can happen in simple model systems. Now, whether you know all the non-universal details in atomic physics will work out to make this happen, I don't know.
No. I was simply going to understand to which extent you can throw away all these details related to all these details.
If you're lucky, this thing is in the very positive region, and then as long as you have you haven't collapsed the clouds completely, then this transition should occur.
Well, if I may, I would like to go back to my condensed matter roots and Sabir doesn't need any defense, but I guess that even though this work may not have taken into account of some of the important, important atomic physics or some of the ephemeral effects, etc. However, I think Sabir and his collaborator has raised a very good point, such as that suppose in the future, may not be now, in the future, suppose we get a condensate of molecules in the boson systems in a lattice whatnot, and there is indeed a difference in symmetry of that system and atomic condensate, and that one has to confront the question of quantum phase transition for that system. May not take precise this form, but then there will be a quantum phase transition.
I think we really need to finish. This has been a long day. So thank you very much.